Welcome to the Mystery College Podcast. Today, I am interviewing Sriram. Sriram is a resident surgeon, and he's been practicing different esoteric systems for pretty much his entire life. And he was initiated into a family system early in his life. Welcome, Sriram.
Good evening, Jake. So how was your day so far?
My day's been fantastic. My day's just started, and your day's kind of coming to a close.
Yeah, it's 9:50 p.m. here. Yeah, it's night. It's okay. So, yeah.
So, first, I wanted to ask you about your childhood, in relation to your practice. Like, can you share about your upbringing in a traditional priest family and how this environment may have influenced your spiritual path?
Okay, so you see, there are in India there are different sects, okay, which are still considered to be castes, but casteism is not exactly the term that I should be using right now. So we belong to a clan called, or we belong to a sect called Brahmins. Brahmins are traditional priests, okay. So initially, they were priests. They never used to do any other occupation except this priestly activities. So I'm from a very orthodox family, okay? I'm from a very orthodox family in South India. And we belong to a certain sect called as Krishna Yajurveda Shaka, or the Black Yajurveda. So there are four Vedas. I think you are aware of these things. So I belong to the Krishna, or the Black sect of Yajurveda. So Yajur means it's basically sacrifices, fire sacrifices and all. So I was initiated after the age of 7, as per the tradition. So once you get initiated, there are certain ritual activities that you should do every day. It's part of the life. You should do that. And then we will start learning Vedas, and we will start learning Vedic hymns and all. So initially, when I was initiated, you know what it was basically. I've been seeing that from my childhood. So I used to see my dad performing these things, and when my elder brother was initiated, I was seeing him doing these things. So it was all natural to me. But I never understood what they mean. Okay, I never understood what they mean. So when I grew up, when I reached my early teens and mid teens, I was asking a lot of questions. Why we are doing this? Why we are doing that at all? So my father, we had a lot of scriptures, okay, initially where I was living. My father brought a lot of scriptures with him. So he used to buy these English translations of Upanishads, okay, and vernacular translations of these Sanskrit treatises so that we can read. So I started to read those things, and I started to understand them bit by bit, what these rituals are, what we are doing. So that is basically based on a sect called as Advaita Vedanta of Shankaracharya. So we belong to that group, okay? So it's basically monistic Vedantic school of Shankara. So this is based on, there are different sects in Vedanta itself. Vedanta means it is the end of Veda. So this is how it all started. So I was reading Shankara's works. So, but it never made complete sense to me. I never had a tradition where I can practice it properly, or I have a very solid practice. Later, when I was like 14 years or 15 years old, I was in high school. Yeah. And that was the time I came across Franz Bader. So how I came across Franz Bader is, I attended these pranic healing courses, okay, of Master Chao Pao Sui. It's like Reiki. Pranic healing is another stuff like Reiki, you might know it. So he has mentioned works written by Franz Bader and works written by members of Theosophical Society, like Let Be the Pranic Besant, etc. So I was into these things. Then when I found Bardhan, I knew that this is a solid system which I can practice. And then I also came across Golden Dawn. So the complete system of Golden Dawn is very complex. So it was too much for me at that point of time. It never made any sense. So I came across Modern Magic by Donald Michael Gregens. And I started practicing the Golden Dawn rituals along with Franz Bardhan's system. So it was at a later stage that I was initiated into what you may call as non-dual Shaivism or Advaita Shaiva. So I came across what you can say as a guru or a master, and I was taught these things. And then I started to delve deeper into the scriptures, like this doctrinal school of Shaivism. Like there are a lot of scriptures, not Vedantic, but Shaivite scriptures, okay? And there are, which are basically called as Agamas and Nigamas. So there are many such scriptures like Malini Jyotira Tantra or Supra Vedadama. Then there is another one called as Mrigendra Adama, all this. Even within these Shaivite systems, there are different sects, like dualistic, non-dualistic, partly dualistic and partly non-dualistic. So many systems. So each one has their own purposes. So the one I predominantly practiced, even that I'm practicing now, is non-dual Shaivism. Okay? And it has been called as Kashmiri Shaivism, which is not true. I think it's a misnomer, because every Shaivite sect evolved from Kashmir only, or that northern part, Nepal, Kashmir and all these things are. So it's non-dual Shaivism, pretty much. So they have certain foundation texts which are translated into Occidental languages these days. One is Tantra Anubha, another one is Tantra Sara, and Spandagariga or Pratyabhijnana Hridaya. All these things are together called as non-dual Shaivite scriptures. Again, there are many divisions in it. I'm not going through it, but to make it complex. So that's that.
Yeah. Can you explain what drew you to Vedanta in particular and how you relate to its non-dual philosophy in your practice or in your work?
Pardon? Can you come again?
Can you share with what drew you to Vedanta and how you relate to the non-dual tradition of Vedanta?
Yeah.
As opposed to Neo-Advaita or dual strict Vedanta?
Okay, see, non-dualistic Vedanta of Shankara, it basically relies on a certain theory called as Vivartavada or Mayavada. So these Vedantic scholars call it as objective reality is an illusion, or the physical reality is an illusion. This is what people say, but that's not Shankara has mentioned. So Shankara has basically mentioned that how we perceive the reality is an illusion. There is a difference. Okay? So he says that Maya is a factor which bails us from perceiving the reality of every object. Okay, Maya is the factor which bails us from perceiving the reality of objects. So the Maya term is from, its etymological derivation is from the root word mana, means to measure. So if we try to measure the infinity, it becomes objective, or it becomes reduced to a certain thing. You're getting the point. So this is how monistic Shaivism also views these doctrines. So this is the truth of it. But initially I was taught that the entire physical universe is an illusion. This is how I was taught. But this was wrong. I later understood when my knowledge in Sanskrit started to increase, I was able to find this out from the doctrines. But on the other hand, Shaivism considers the physical reality to be the exalted will of the Supreme Lord. Okay? It is called as Bimba Pratibimba Vada, or many other things are that, but Bimba Pratibimba means reflection. Bimba means reflection. So the reflection. And Swatantra Vada means freedom or sovereignty. So that means it is the freedom of the Supreme Lord to create, which manifests the universe in his own image, okay? So how they differ? Simple. The non-dual Shaivism considers the entire existence or the entire reality to be three. or it manifests in three dimensions. So yeah, one is the dimension of subjectivity. Second one is the dimension of cognition. And the third one is the dimension of objectivity. So it is called as Pramana, Prameya and Pramadratraya in Sanskrit terminology. So they consider the Supreme Lord to be pure consciousness, which is beyond time and space, beyond the limitations of the temporal constructs. So the consciousness manifests as subject, cognition and object.
Subject, cognition and object.
Yes. So, are you able to follow me here?
As best as I can, yes.
Okay. So, here, the subject is the ultimate. Okay. He manifests the object in his own image. You're getting the point. So, one way to understand this is, for example, this is how I tell everyone, okay, when somebody is getting confused with what I'm saying, and I will try to reveal this fact through a simple example. For example, we are looking at a red color. Red. So we are perceiving something called as color red. Okay. And there are a lot of meanings assigned to that one color red. For a communist, it is the color of revolution. Okay. It's the color of revolution. And for a warrior or for a soldier, it might be the color of or blood. It might be traumatic food. And it is also the color of passion. The red rose signifies lust, passion, romantic attraction, etc. So, for each of them, the meaning differs. So, all these meanings are assigned to that particular object by us. Okay, so from a higher perspective, it's different. So what I'm saying now is just try to understand the simple logic, okay? So all these meanings are assigned by us. So that's it. So what is the reality of the object? Are we able to perceive the object as it is?
No.
We are not able to perceive the object as it is. We are not able to perceive the object without judging. We are judging the object based on our own pre-cognitive ideas or whatever that we have before. We are just assigning these ideas, but they are not the reality of the object. So this kind of differentiation that we are making in the objective world is Maya. This is as per non-dual Shaivism, okay? Okay, so now this triadic manifestation, this triad is considered to be Shakti. Okay, so hence you might have heard a lot of things about Kali. Kali is a goddess in India. So people will say she's the goddess of time, she's about time, she's a goddess of death, all these things. But that's not how the doctrinal schools of Shaivism practice. So Shiva is the consciousness, and Shiva manifests in three phases as subject, object and cognition. And these three manifestations are in the form of Kali.
Read.
Okay, so that is Para, Apara and Para, Apara. So Para means supreme. Para, Apara means partly supreme and partly non-supreme. And Apara, you can call it as infernal or something very gross, objective in nature. So the para aspect is basically assigned to the subjectivity. Okay? And the apara aspect is assigned to objectivity. And the para apara, which is in the middle, is assigned the dimension of cognition. So these are the three manifestations of the law. So if you look at it from a not from an empirical view, but as a totality of existence, if you look at it, the entire universe is triadic in nature. Okay? Entire universe is triadic in nature. So God manifests in triadic form, and universe is nothing but a reflection of the God. Okay, so these are state. So these three dimensions are state of awareness as well. Okay, the dimension of objectivity is nothing but an outer awareness. Here, the individual is completely ignorant about his own nature. Okay, he considers the external objects to be different from him.
Enough, that was it. What? And with Amber, look at that.
Getting the point.
Ooh.
Okay. So when he is rising from the dimension of objectivity and when he reaches the parabara concept or the dimension of cognition, he realizes that the outer objects also exist within himself. Okay? The outer reality also exists within him. You're getting the point. And again, he is rising above that aspect. He is reaching the para aspect or the dimension of subjectivity. So what happens there? The individual realizes that the outer objects are a reflection of his inner selves. Okay? So here the external reality is one with his internal reality. So basically his awareness is going inside, he's going inward. Okay, at some point of time, the entire external objective awareness ceases and the inner awareness develops. At that point of time, the person realizes his true self, which is nothing, that he realizes that he is the God. Okay, so again, these three aspects manifests in a fourfold manner. In a fourfold manner. If the subject, cognition, and object manifests in a fourfold manner. So, those fourfold, along with these three, manifests as 12 Kalis. So, there are 12 Kali. Yeah, 4 into 3 is 12. Okay? So, these processes are called as Utsheba, Avaksheba, Alangrasa, etc. Okay? See, what they mean is, one is emission. Kali means, the term Kali refers to the etymological, the root word is kalana, means to throw, to emanate. To emanate. So what is she emanating? She's emanating or she's throwing up or she's projecting what is there in the consciousness. So this process of projection or emanate. Then sustenance. Whatever that has been projected or emanated has to be sustained. Okay? Then the withdrawal. Then dissolution. So these four processes happens in three dimensions of subject, cognition, and object. Hence, 12. So 12 Kalis. Getting the point? Okay. So our reality has to be meditated or has to be contemplated in these 12 phases in order to realize the true self. So eventually you rise above the constraints of time and space and you realize that only the true self is real. Rest, everything that you are seeing outside is a reflection of your own self. You're not thinking it's an illusion, but those objectification is like putting limits to your own self or to the godly self. So what exactly happens is you will be able to understand that everything is a reflection of God and God alone. So this is one of the fundamental practices.
And what's the title that what speaks to the totality of what that practice is? Is that called Kali Kula tradition, or what is it called exactly?
No. Kali Kula, again, the Kali Kula tradition differs from one place to another. So I'm from the state of Kerala, where the Kali Kula tradition mainly is about Rurujit Vidhana. Rurujit, there are five principal forms of Kali in that, okay? Rurujit, Dakshajit, Darugajit, then Raktakali, etc. are there. So that is one. So another one that you can see in North India is in the Bengal areas, which is called as Kalighata, which is now called as Calcutta. Initially, it was called as Kalighata, Ghat of Kali. Means the mountainous regions, so the hilly regions of Kali. So there is a tradition called as Dakshina Kali. Dakshina means right, or it also refers to the south. There are certain Egyptian deities. There is a deity named Somdet. She represents the southern star of the Sothis, which is Canis Major. So she also represents something similar. So here we have 15 forms of Kali worship, which refers to the 15 waning phases of the moon. Okay, so that's one thing. So here I told you that there are four processes which happens in these three dimensions, which results story. Here there are five processes happening in three dimensions. That is what Dakshina Kali traditions. One more process is added. Yeah. So that is pure enlightenment, which is called as Bhasavastha. So after the withdrawal phase, there is a dissolution phase, which is the fourth process. And there is a fifth process which comes right before the emanation phase. That is the pre-manifestation phase. That is also added as pure enlightenment or Bhasavastha. This makes it five. So 5 into 3 is 15. Okay? The ultimate reality is the 16th phases, Kali. So these concepts, the works written by Kenneth Grant tries to address these concepts, but their information on these doctrines are very less, or they don't have much knowledge about this. So they have written what they know about it. But yeah, sure, it's a good attempt to answer these questions. He has mentioned 16 kalas. So these are the 16 kalas. So these are the 16 manifestations of the divine, what I told you now. So even though it is not written in detail in those words, but it is giving some sort of idea or some sort of introductions. Sometimes it can be misleading, but they have tried to address these concepts from what they knew or from what they learned. So that's it. So another one is Srividya tradition, which basically addresses the Supreme Goddess Lalita Tripurasundari. So she is also worshipped in 15 forms, and she also has a triadic manifestation, Bala Sundari Bhairavi. So this triadic manifestation is Bala is a little girl. Bala means little girl. Sundari is a maiden who has started her menstrual cycle. She's a maiden. Bhairavi is a menopausal woman. Okay. So that is a prana aspect. You're getting upon it. So Hecate is represented, Hecate, a Greek goddess. She's represented as maiden, mother, and prana. But here, child, maiden, and a prana.
Oui.
Okay. So these three aspects refers to the subject, object, and cognition phase only. Okay. Also, creation, preservation, destruction. But the creation, preservation, destruction is not the right term, because that's not the right term. Much more better term is emanation, sustenance, and withdrawal, which I have already explained. So this is how we our tradition on almost all the systems view the mystical arts or the spiritual traditions or the spiritual initiations are viewed from this perspective.
Here three the back.
Yeah. The triad.
The triad.
That's it. Yeah. So that's one thing.
I'm wondering, where do you find there to be particular intersection between triadic thought and also the different manifestations of these godhead and deities with where certain passages of time and their different states of development. I wonder if there's intersection with that and any different type of traditions that are more occidental or more Western, like the Hermetics or the Golden Dawn or other practices you may have explored.
There are a lot of intersections, to be exact. there are a lot of intersections. One thing is, when I started practicing the Golden Dawn system, the Kabbalistic tree, which has 22 paths and 10 sephiroths, which means it 32. 32, okay? So, how the 32 is seen in Indian tradition? It is called as Dwatrinshat Kala. So, there are mantras assigned to these deities, which are 32 syllables. Okay, you might be familiar with the work Key to the True Kabbalah by Franz Bader. Okay? So, there is a system in Indian tradition as well, which is called as Mantraka, which forms the mantras like Om, Preem, String, etc. But it is not practiced properly. People think that you repeat the mantra or chant the mantra for 1,000 times, 10,000 times, or 100,000, it will start yielding results. No, that's not how it works. It's a certain sophisticated system which you need to understand properly. Okay, so each of the phonemes, just like how Key to the True Kabbalah is, there is a system in Indian tradition as well. This is one thing. And the 32 paths, which I mentioned a little earlier, it also corresponds to Indian system as well. So I have told you how the 16 manifests, right? 16. Now the 16 manifests in two phases. Okay, two phases. So one is a reflection of the other. So it reflects, which makes it 32. Okay, which makes it 32. So how the 16 and the 32 comes into action is, you might have seen the pentacephalic form of Shiva with five heads, with five faces, Panchamukhi Shiva. So it basically represents his five activities or five powers, Chit, Ananda, Ichha, Jnana and Kriya. These five aspects manifests as 16, which are represented by 16 vowels in Sanskrit alphabets. Okay? 16 vowels. So these 16 reflects or manifests for making it 32. We are going deeper and deeper into this. Okay, it's the same with the Typhonian tradition of Kenneth Grant. Okay, and the Typhonian trilogy, like the Cults of the Shadow, the Night Side of Eden, etc., and Aleister Crowley and the Hidden Goddess, all these works mentions these aspects of the divinity of the 32 aspects. Okay, so the Kabbalistic tree, which is 32, the Clifotic tree is also 32. Then there is something else. In Haitian Wodan, they call it as 32 crossroads or the 32 paths of the cross. This is something that you might not see in any works, written works. But those who are initiated into the Wodan current by a proper Haungan or by a proper Wodan priest knows the secret. There are 32 spirits that they work with. Okay, I'm not going deeper into that. So there is a system which works with these 32 currents. It is also the same. You're getting the point. Okay. And then, yeah, these are the similarities that I found.
Yeah.
Because these are the principal parts that I have practiced, like Asian Wodan, Kabbalah, and then Indian system.
That is a very rich intersection between these different systems. I hadn't thought of the implications of the numerology as well. And yeah, that's pretty immense. Pretty immense. I'm curious too about, well, I'll have to do some more podcasts, to be frankly. There's so much scope to cover. But for now, I'm curious about, like, as a surgical resident who comes from the lineage of Ayurvedic Vaidya, how do you integrate your spiritual beliefs with modern medical practices? Or if there's a sectionality?
See, for me, there are, in India, you can see there are, there is a certain sort of medical purism. Like there is an Ayurvedic purism, and then there is a modern medical or Western medicine purism. I don't want to say it as Western medicine. I want to say it as modern medicine. So Ayurveda and modern medicine. So Ayurveda considers these old Indian philosophers like tattvas and all. So the psycho-spiritual mind. And they consider the three humor theory, which is much more sophisticated from the Western system of three humor theory. We call it as Vata Pitta Kapha, which are formed by the five principal elements, that is earth, water, fire, etc. Okay. Prithvi, Aap, Agni, or Teja, then Vayu, and Adasha. These are the five elements. So we consider this. So Vata is formed by Adasha and Vayu, or the air and Adasha. Then Pitta is formed by water and Agni, or fire. Then we have Kapha, which is water and earth. So these are the principal building blocks of the body and mind. So again, the mind is composed of three principal elements, that is sattva, rajas and tamas, all this is. But when you delve deeper into these Sankhitas or these classical Ayurvedic treatises, and when you start looking at the modern medicine, you will be amazed. So there is this incredible surgeon named Sushruta. Okay, Sushruta. He is very famous. Australian Royal College of Surgeons erected a statue, his statue in front of their surgical school. And even in Chennai, where I am doing my residency right now, there is a very famous college named Stanley Medical College, which was established by the British people. There also you can see a huge statue of Sushruta. And medical fraternities all over the world are considering to be the first surgeon or first plastic surgeon. He is called as the father of plastic surgery in India. So if you look at history, his name is Sushruta Samira. Yes, mentioned many surgical practices. Rhinoplasty, oroplasty, chelioplasty, reconstruction surgeries. He has also mentioned surgeries for hydrocele and for traumatic injuries, suturing techniques, and then bandaging techniques. And without an x-ray, he classified fractures and dislocations. He classified dislocations into 6 types. He classified fractures into 12 types. Okay? You cannot classify it much more better than that. Even in this era, with x-rays and other investigation procedures, you cannot classify it much more better than him. Okay? And he has mentioned rhinoplastic surgeries, split thickness skin graft, full thickness skin graft. These are the two main skin grafting techniques currently available in plastic surgery. Then there are flap surgeries. Sushruta was not able to do flap surgeries, he has not mentioned. But one of the other things that I saw in Sushruta Samhita is that he has mentioned a lot of ocular surgeries. Okay, he has mentioned a lot of ophthalmological surgeries, which includes cataract surgery. So the Western people thinks that he was doing couching. There is a technique called as couching. These are all medical terminologies. He was not doing couching. He was doing extracapsular lens extraction, which is the current surgical protocol for cataract. Extracapsular lens extraction with the intraocular implantation. That is one of the techniques done by modern ophthalmic surgeons. Some of them do laser cataract surgeries as well. That is much more advanced. But Sushruta had knowledge about extracapsular lens extraction, and he has documented it properly in Sushruta Samhita. So, I'm not claiming these things. They're all well documented and recorded, okay? It's not a simple claim. So, they were so advanced during that time. He was limited by the technological availability or the limitations in technology. That's all. Same goes for Charaka, who is considered to be the father of Indian medicine. So he has mentioned many conditions which are now mentioned in modern medicine, like, and there is a certain chapter named, I was reading this chapter a few days back, okay, named as Shota. Shota means generalized edema, edematous condition. So if I start talking about it, it will go little deep, it will become a medical talk. I don't want that to happen. So in that specific chapter, he has mentioned edema which arises due to cardiac failure in cardiac disorders, generalized edema which arises in end-stage liver disease and in end-stage, that is CKD, chronic kidney disease. He has mentioned all these diseases properly. These are also not claims. These are well documented. So these people had an idea about all these conditions 3,000 years back. So these treatises were compiled during the 1000 or 1500 BC time. As per the archaeological evidence that we have, these were compiled during those days, like 1500 BC. This is the timeline. So they were doing all these things. So even though they talk about these five elements and how the body is made of the five elements and all, while the modern medicine might not agree with those theories, but both of them are same for me. They are looking at the disease from two different perspectives, that's all. Yeah. So what I understand is that we are not supposed to be a purist. We should be able to integrate these two sciences properly. That is, technologically, we are far more better than those days. So we can use these investigative procedures to come at a proper diagnosis. And we need to understand how they are correlated in Ayurveda. Okay? And then we should give a proper treatment for the patient. So such kind of integrated approach is necessary. Purism is madness.
Yes. With.
That's pretty phenomenal hearing about the history and that they had rhinoplasty and skin grafting and all these other things 3,500 years ago. And then they're only really limited by some technological challenges that we've only had up until we only had access to until very recently.
Yeah.
Pretty phenomenal. So I'm wondering too, like you... From my research, you actually have an upcoming book titled The Heart as Supreme Player.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was supposed to be the Falcon Books agreed to publish it, but it's now on a hiatus because I need to edit a lot of the chapters in it. Mm. I wrote that book in 3 to 4 months' time. Like, I was preparing for my entrance itself for my PG entrance back in 2021-22. I was very staunch on joining surgical residency. I told my father that if I'm not getting a surgical residency, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going for any other branch. He said, whatever the branch that you are getting, whether it's another clinical subject or a paraclinical subject, go for it. I was very staunch. I was very stubborn. I need surgical residency or else I'm not going. This was my answer. Okay. So that was a very tough phase. And then I wrote the exam and my rank list came and I was waiting for the allotment. So there was like almost 4 or 5 months of time. There was a gap before I joined the residency. So during that time, I wrote this work. So it has a lot of grammatical errors. And so it was written in and how to say. And yeah, I'm not a native speaker, so you can understand there might be errors in it. And also the words that I used are a little confusing because the concept itself is very difficult to grasp. So the editor told me that I have to redo the work. I don't have time to redo the work anytime soon. So I don't think it will be published anytime soon. It's the first thing. And the Heart of Supreme Bhairava, I named it as Heart of Supreme Bhairava because Parabhairava Hridaya, that is a Sanskrit name that I like to give it. Heart means core, Parabhairava means the Supreme Bhairava. So Supreme Bhairava is, Bhairava is a compound word. It is made of Bara and Va, 3 syllables. So Bharana, Rava and Vamana. Bharana means to sustain, to rule. Rava means... There are different meanings for Rava. Here it refers to emission or emanation. Rava means howling, so it's not emanation, my bad. It is destruction or withdrawal, Rava. And Vamana means to emanate. for the project. So Bhairava. So it refers to the triadic manifestation. So the heart of the triadic manifestation means this book covers all the major aspects of non-dual shyness. So I want to do it in a two-part, two-volume work. So one, the first volume will cover all the theoretical aspects of it. Second volume will cover the practical aspects of it. So I'm writing it in a manner where any person who has an open mind can study it and practice it properly. So I'm mentioning about the triadic manifestation. I have written about Kali and the various manifestations, all the 12 manifestations. I have described in detail 3 manifestations of Kali. I have described it in detail. What is Shiva and Shakti? How they are one and same. How our consciousness is nothing, the manifestation of Parashiva. What are the 5 aspects of the 5 powers of Shiva? Alphabets. How the 5 powers or the manifestations of Shiva corresponds to the vowels. There are 51 alphabets in Sanskrit. Each of them has been considered to be a certain manifestation of Shiva in certain phases. That one. And 36 tattvas or the 36 psycho-spiritual elements which makes up the self and the universe. All these things I have mentioned it. Then one more thing, Kundalini. I have mentioned what really Kundalini is. It's a misinterpreted concept in West, both East and West. So whatever that Indian spirituality now, so-called Indian spirituality knows about Kundalini comes from writings of Western authors like Annie Besant, Madame Blavatsky, Leadbeater, this Theosophical Society. So again, it's misinterpreted. So I have written about that as well. So all these things I covered it, and I want to include how to meditate on alphabets, how to meditate on certain mantras, how to contemplate the 12 processes of divinity as 12 kalis, and all these things in the second part.
Yeah, that's a pretty phenomenal scope of work that you have. In this book, this draft you have. So I hope in some time it's able to get published or an editor to revitalize it and make it accessible to the public. That'd be wonderful. But I understand that other obligations are perhaps more pressing, such as people's lives in surgery.
Yeah. I'm not going to work as a trauma surgeon or an emergency surgeon in the future. But there will be surgical emergencies if I become a minimal access surgeon or a gastroenterological surgeon as well.
Yeah.
So I'm not going into the trauma part. It's not for me. So maybe we'll see.
We'll see. For listeners who are interested in exploring spiritual practices or integrating spirituality into their into the lives in a more fulfilled, succinct way, what advice would you offer for people to start integrating spiritual practices?
First thing, never try to divide your material life and spiritual life. They are one and the same. Okay? Your material life should be a reflection of your spiritual evolution. What you do in the world should be a reflection of your spiritual journey. You are sitting in a room, you are talking about Vedanta, you are talking about Kabbalah, or you are talking about the concepts of these things. You are talking about different sephiras, what they correspond to, or you are talking about Shaivism, what are the tattvas and how it corresponds. And you are talking about this oneness and all, but you are not doing anything in the real world, it means it's a waste of time. I think you should contribute to the society. You should be contributing in a productive manner. You should be productive. As such, your life should reflect your spiritual self. For me, as a doctor, it reflects my spiritual journey. If I'm not able to contribute anything of value to the society, it's a waste of time. So the more and more I delved into these spiritual mysteries, the more and more my path became clear to it. And this is my path. I should do this. First thing is that never try to divide spiritual life and material life. Both are one answer. Both should complement each other. Okay. This is the first advice that I would like to give. Second one, don't go behind masters. Don't go behind people who promises liberation and all. Instead, there are scriptures, there are books, there are... It was difficult in the past to get certain books, certain scriptures. But now in this world of information, we can have anything. Anything. If you can have Upanishads from India there, it can be delivered as a hard copy, or you can download it as a soft copy. You can download these. There are now, the Oriental Library is doing a project where they are digitalizing all the manuscripts, handwritten palm leaf manuscripts. So, and they are uploading it for free. Okay, even you can have these manuscripts at your fingertips. You can download them for free. So all these closely guarded secrets are now available to the public, and you can make good use of it. It's not like the olden days. Okay, a couple of decades back, you could not do any of this. It was very difficult. But now it's not like that. So do your own research. And never try to criticize other spiritual traditions. Never try to criticize other spiritual traditions. Just accept whatever that is of value to you and discard it a bit. That's all.
That's all. That's it. So, are there any new projects or teachings or practices that you're looking to look forward to exploring for yourself or with sharing with others?
I am trying to explore Nordic tradition.
Weird.
Currently. Somehow the Nordic tradition resonates with me. The rules and the God Odin. I don't know. I even have a ring consecrated for Odin. So I wear it. So it resonates with me. So I meditate on runes. I am meditating on runes these days, and I'm meditating on Odin and also other deities like Thor, Loki, Tyr, etc.
That's wonderful. And is there any last piece of advice you'd give someone who's looking to explore, the spiritual, some of the spiritual traditions we've mentioned, like non-dual Vedanta or Shaivism, or practice
Kali you are saying
Kali Pisa.
The pronunciation, the Western pronunciation is wrong. You guys pronounce it as Kali. Kali Kula. So yeah, the first thing what I will say is try to learn Sanskrit. Then read the scriptures. And that's the advice that I want to give. Learn Sanskrit, read the scriptures. Or else it can be really confusing. I've seen an English translation of this Tantra Amrita. This is the magnum opus work of a saint named Abhinav Gupta. So it is considered to be our Bible. Bible of non-dual Shaivites. Okay, so the English translation is, oh my God, it broke my heart. And the translation was done by an Indian. And the translations were, what can I say, horrible. It was an appalling experience trading through it, honestly. It's better to stick with Sanskrit commentary. There is a Jayarada commentary, which is also, and then there is a Hindi translation, which is really good, okay? The Hindi translation was done by an author named Paramahansa Mishra. It's a really good one. So better learn Sanskrit and then read these words. That's better. These are all written in a manner where a person can follow or practice it in solitude. All these works are basically, see, there is a concept of guru, but in non-dual Shaivism, the guru is considered to be Bhairava itself, the Supreme God. Okay? And it manifests as the inner self. So, Abhinavagupta said it as Swatma Prakashrupa, means the self-reflecting nature. Swatma Prakashrupa, self-reflective or self-illuminating nature of the self is Bhairava. Okay, that means that you are your own master, and that is the truth. So once you are ready, the secrets of the universe will reveal itself to you. Okay, I had somebody to guide me, that's a different thing. But still, if my book has been published in the near future or in the late future, whenever it is, let me tell you, that book can serve as a starting point into these traditions. Then, if they want to further their knowledge and their practice, let them learn Sanskrit and then read the scriptures and practice directly from it. That's it.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And is there any way, or are you offering any services to the general public at this time, or methods of contact, or are you keeping that all?
It's nothing. I, at this point of time, I can't do any of those things.
Because, yeah.
It's really busy. Actually, the resident, it's going away. Especially the surgical resident. If you look at radiology or dermatology or any other clients, or any other paraclinical center, it's easy for them. They need to work from 9 to 4 or 9 to 5 and they can go home. The surgical residency is quite like, it's really tough. So yeah, one more year and then again there will be a super specialty residency and definitely we are doing that there, right? Yeah. So some sort of sub-specialty or a super specialty, I'm gonna do it. Fantastic.
Like so. Well, thank you so much for your time. We'll speak soon.
Yeah, you're welcome. And what's the time then now?
Oh, right now it's 9 a.m.
9 a.m. Look, it's 10:40 p.m. here. So have a good day. It's a nice talking with you. I'm looking forward for more of these kind of conversations.
Likewise.
And thank you.